and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C. Zimbabwe's government confers national hero status to late nationalist Ndabaningi Sithole Saturday.
There's no way that he cannot be an election gimmick. Because the first question one asks, why wasn't it done long ago? Why now, 2 months away from the election?
Sierra Leoneans are rejoicing following the election of the country to the UN Security Council as a non-permanent member.
This is very significant in more ways than one. The last time we were there was in 1971. Governments have come and gone. We have not been able to achieve that feat.
And a Gambian lawmaker calls on colleagues to stop the debt pileup by the government of President Adama Barrow.
I'm very worried and I'm very disturbed about the trend of the Gambia government's borrowing. I would say reckless borrowing. Because for me, you should look at your economy, the performance of your economy, and try to project what you can do and what you cannot do.
Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. A Zimbabwean analyst says the decision by the government to confer national hero status to late nationalist Ndabaningi Sithole is not likely to have any significant impact on the coming August general election. Dr. Ibo Mandaza says the decision appears to be politically motivated, which he argued is aimed at generating votes for the governing party in the upcoming August elections. His remarks come after the government announced it will confer national hero status to Sithole on Saturday, June 10. Sithole, a late cleric, is the founder of the Zimbabwe African National Union, or ZANU, a militant socialist group that fought against white minority rule for independence and a founding leader of the ruling party. For analysis, I reached Dr. Ibo Mandaza in the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
Well, I mean, there's no way that it cannot be an election gimmick. Because the first question one asks, why wasn't it done long ago? Why now, 2 months away from the election? That's the first thing. It was overdue for Sithole to be declared a national hero. One doesn't declare anybody, and a national hero is never declared. A national hero is self-evident. It's self-evident that Sithole was a national hero from long ago. And those of us who witnessed his burial decades ago, I even wrote an obituary and we complained at the denial of heroes for men was obviously a hero. The question now, of course, is that in my view, it appears farcical and a bit belated to declare and then saw the hero on the eve of election. And even if it's not a gimmick, it will be seen as such anyway.
Well, but Doc, some people are suggesting that if a wrong has been committed, it has to be corrected. And the move the president is making is a good move, that a nation should celebrate its heroes, like Mr. Sithole. What do you say to that?
Well, it's hardly an event. It's not even an event at all here. You know, they've gone without passing at all, you know, without notice. That's how unceremonious it is, if I may say so. It lacks the grandeur that should accompany such an event, because it's done hurriedly, it's done for out of expediency. It's something that should be well prepared. And one could have done it on the national, you know, week in August, you know. So all that adds to the suspicion that this is an election gimmick, regrettably.
But how are Zimbabweans on the ground responding to this announcement by the government?
They've gone without notice, really, largely. The only thing that has risen is that there would be political significance of it, whether it's a gimmick or not. Otherwise, it's gone unnoticed.
Do you foresee this having any impact?
No, there's no impact at all. There's no impact at all. Perhaps only at the local level in Kenya, but even there, the people are able to question about the timing of it. It's not a national event, you see. When you do these things and make it so partisan as an act by Mnangagwa, as a partisan act, you draw a lot of suspicion, notwithstanding the good motives behind it. And I'm sorry to say, but I don't think it will have any impact at all.
Dr. Ibo Mandaza is a Zimbabwe analyst. He spoke with me from the capital, Harare. Sierra Leoneans are rejoicing following the election of the country to the UN Security Council as a non-permanent member of the world body. After 53 years of absence, the country received an overwhelming number of votes to become one of two African representatives at the world body. Information Minister Mohamed Rahman Sowore says the election is a culmination of President Julius Maada Bio's commitment to strategically position the country in the international community. It is a victory for all citizens, irrespective of their political preferences, he added. Meanwhile, the president has stepped up his campaign in readiness for the coming June 24 general election. Incumbent President Bio is seeking a second and final five-year term. Information Minister Mohamed Rahman Sowore tells me that Sierra Leoneans are proud of the election to the UN role and equally confident that the coming elections to choose new leaders will be peaceful.
This is very significant in more ways than one. Firstly, the last time we were there was in 1971. Governments have come and gone. We have not been able to achieve that feat. His Excellency President Julius Maada Bio had an avowed determination to launder the image of our country and reposition her for both local and international respectability. So this came as a payoff of the efforts he has made over the years to reposition our country as a respected member of the International Committee of Nations. But to many watchers of Sierra Leone, this is not a surprise. Already, he is chairperson of the African Peer Review Mechanism. He is chairperson of the Committee of 10 for the reform of the UN Security Council. And last year, during the Transforming Education Summit, he co-chaired that session with the UN Secretary General and is one of few African leaders that is leading, you know, the resolving the crisis in global education. So President Bio is a giant figure when it comes to international diplomacy. So this is a glorious moment for our country. It shows that Sierra Leone is truly and honestly on the ascendance.
How are the people reacting to this news?
This is another one which has been roundly celebrated by Sierra Leoneans across the political divide. They all acknowledge President Bio has dared where others have failed. He has succeeded where others have tried without much success. So this is a crowning glory of achievement for our country.
Well, I understand the president has also stepped up his campaign ahead of the June 24th general election. How are things going so far?
If you were to see the president now, you will see a very energized, a very enthused, a very confident President Julius Maada Bio on the campaign trail. He has literally been to every nook and cranny of the country. And in many of these communities, it is they who have been recounting the kind of achievements his government has made in the last 5 years in extremely difficult circumstances of the twin problems of the Russia-Ukraine war and of COVID. So in many communities, it's been testimony moment. So he's very confident, really confident that he'll win these elections on the first ballot. And that is already so clear for even the blind to see.
Mohammed, some of the opposition supporters are expressing concern that they are being prevented from campaigning in the strongholds
of the ruling party, and they are expressing also concern about violence, they said, unleashed by thugs.
I have been on the campaign trail with His Excellency. The campaigns have been very decorous, but politicians who do not have a message only seek recourse to violence as a means of coercing people to vote for them. In my village, for example, a group of APC thugs went there, attacked very unsuspecting villagers. As I speak to you, the village chief is battling for his dear life in hospital. He had an acid attack. He had to undergo a skin grafting operation. So this is very serious. They were perpetrators. But by and large, the campaign has remained very focused. President Bio has a message. He has a record to run on. And as government, we are the biggest beneficiaries of a peaceful, stable, and tranquil environment, which is why at every campaign stop, he has enjoined his supporters and all and sundry to keep this campaign peaceful and to eschew violence from the body politic.
Talking about the elections, does the ruling party, or for that matter, the president, have confidence in the Electoral Commission to administer credible and transparent elections? Because some of the opposition people are saying that it appears the Electoral Commission is tilted to favor the ruling party.
That is another loose, gaseous allegation. We went into the 2018 elections with everything skewed against us. We did not need all of this paraphernalia to win the elections. He won it with all the odds stacked against him. So now that he's been here in 5 years, he does not need any special favors. He simply wants a free, fair, and credible elections. He simply wants a transparent process, which the ECSL, the Electoral Commission for Sierra Leone, has promised all parties. But because the APC is ill-prepared for these elections, because they know if elections were held today, any day, the president is going to pit them on the first ballot, that is why they are rigging up every excuse, real and imaginary, to escape the elections. In some instances, some of their proteges have even called for the postponement of the elections. But this election date is carved in marble. Elections will happen, and those who have a message should reach out to the people to preach it so that they can convince voters. President Bio is doing his homework with Madam First Lady. They have gone to every place, and we are very pleased with the reception, and we are pretty confident that we'll pull off the elections.
Mohamed Rahman Soare is Sierra Leone's information minister. He spoke with me from the capital, Freetown.
Has social media improved your life, or is it more of a distraction? We'd love to hear from you. You can call us 24/7 on WhatsApp and leave a message. We may play your message on VOA Africa. Dial the international code +1, then 202-258-3076. The number again, +1-202-258-3076. Can't wait to hear from you.
In the Gambia, a lawmaker is calling on colleagues to stop the debt racked up by the government of President Adama Barrow. Yaya Sanyang says the administration appears to be engaging in excessive borrowing, which he contends could bankrupt the West African country. His remarks came after the government presented a motion in parliament seeking approval for a $50 million loan. It is to be used to import petroleum products, food, and other commodities the administration considers essential. Parliamentarian Yaya Sanyang tells me that he will continue with the effort to stop the government from what he says are unsustainable excessive borrowing.
I'm very worried and I'm very disturbed about the trend of the Gambia government's borrowing, I would say reckless borrowing. Because for me, you should look at your economy, the performance of your economy, and try to project what you can do and what you cannot do. Because historically, I said it yesterday, if you look at Jawara who ruled this country, former President Jawara, ruled this country for 30 good years, and the amount of money borrowed before 1994 was just 19 billion dollars. President Jammeh took over from Jawara in 1994. President Jammeh ruled this country for 22 good years. The amount of money borrowed was just some 52 billion dollars. This government, within a span of 7 years, the loan snowball up to 100 plus billion dollars. This is worrying. This is worrying. This is disturbing, and this cannot continue.
So you say the plan to stop the government from what you described as excessive borrowing is to stop or prevent the government from being able to borrow. How would you plan to do that?
Yeah, exactly. I can only do that when I have the support of the National Assembly member. And that's why I told every National Assembly on political divides, both the NPP, the UDP, the APRC, the Independent, I told them individually, I engage them individually. I make telephone conversations. I call them at night. I call them in the morning. I call them at every time. Let's tomorrow we are going to the National Assembly. Let's get this loan agreement. It's not good for the country. It's not just that. That's the only thing we can do. The National Assembly is the only institution that can stop the government from borrowing, because that is why they bring all loan agreements to the National Assembly for us to ratify. If we say no, it is no.
The experts say that the borrowing is strategic and to boost agricultural production to feed the people and for infrastructure development, it's good for the country because these loans will be paid for because of the what it will provide for the Gambian economy. It will significantly boost the Gambian economy and create jobs for the youth who do not have them.
This is deliberately misleading. This is not true. They have been borrowing and we have not seen how our lives are impacted, how the ordinary Gambians' lives are impacted. They have been borrowing money for the projects. Those projects are still stagnated. Those projects are not moving. They have been borrowing money for the agricultural sector for the past 50 years. We have not seen agricultural productivity increasing. In fact, when President Jawara was there, President Jammeh was there, agricultural productivity was 21. When this government came, the productivity has dropped down to 19%. It was 21% during Yahya Jammeh's time, and now agricultural productivity, according to the International Monetary Fund, has dropped to 19%. So all the monies they have been borrowing to boost agricultural productivity, where is that money going to?
It's not. But some people are suggesting that there's climate change. Yahya Jammeh's term and Jawara's term over 30 years ago, the situations have changed, so you can't compare the two. When there are more challenges to face now.
When we go to the basic definition of climate and weather, the day-to-day condition of the atmosphere, climate changes after every 30 or 40 years. So that is not true. We're still within the same climatic zone. Yes, there is climate impact, but it's so minimal. It's so negligible as far as our government context is concerned. So it's not about climate. This was about reckless economic management, reckless project management. People are employed in projects who have no knowledge to steer the affairs of those projects. This is the problem in this country. They are using, they are borrowing money for agriculture. It's not, nothing is changing in agriculture. I've been to the provinces. I'm in the select committee on agriculture. I've been into the provinces. I'm so discouraged. I'm so disturbed. I'm the chair for government project monitoring and implementation. I have gone over all these projects. They are not moving. The quality is bad. The money injected into this project is not. Governments are not getting value for money.
Yahya Sanyang is a parliamentarian from the Gambia. He spoke with me from the capital, Banjul. In Nigeria, President Asiwa Jubola Ahmed Tinubu is calling for patience as workers express concern that the removal of a fuel subsidy is imposing tough economic conditions on their members. Workers groups say the prices of goods and services have significantly increased after the president announced the removal of government support. Meanwhile, the president has also tasked Vice President Kashim Shettima to lead an economic team to come up with measures to cushion the effect of the removal of the subsidy. For more on the impact of the new policy, I reach Abuja-based political analyst Ibrahim Momo.
It's now almost inevitable that immediate price increase occasioned by the fuel subsidy removal has come to stay. And so they are adjusting in whatever ways they can, spending, driving less, communicating. Nigerians are, roads are freer, so to say now. of cars, and we're looking out to see the outcome of the negotiation between the federal government, the state government, organized private sectors, and the labor unions to see what palliatives there are. But the Nigerians are also waiting to see how the vice president, who is the head of the National Economic Council, what palliatives they will bring forth.
You know, the TUC and other institutions, including the Nigeria Labor Congress, threatened to go on strike. A court, you know, kicked back and prevented them from going on strike. But people are expressing concern that prices of goods and services have sharply increased, especially in Abuja. They said petroleum, for that matter, has sometimes doubled or tripled. And they are worried that their monies or public service sectors will not be able to afford that sharp rise in services and goods.
Because of the centrality or the place petroleum products hold in our, refined petroleum products hold in our economy, virtually every sector of the economy is affected by the increase in prices of the pump price of petroleum products, occasioned by the purported fuel subsidy removal. You see, the transport fares have gone up, food prices have gone up. Even other commonly used goods, clothes, tuition fees, across the spectrum of the economy, there seems to be a general kind of inflation. In its proposal to the government, the TUC has asked for an increase in the minimum wage from the current 30,000 naira to 200,000 naira. That is about 680% increase. That's what one of the requests by the TUC as a way coping with the price increases. President Tinubu's government has also put forth the fact that one of the ways they wish to, you know, provide palliatives for the increased costs will be a review of the national minimum wage, such that workers get to earn a larger pay. But, you know, commentators, including myself, have argued that if all you are going to do is just increase the salaries of workers, the first thing is that how many Nigerians are in the federal civil service?
Is their request feasible, looking at that the government is now trying to put its house in order, trying to name a cabinet and trying to name of public officials who will help the president to administer the affairs of the country? Is this feasible?
Well, the argument the government has put forth for wanting to remove the money spent on the payment for fuel subsidy is that it will free up funds, budgeted funds for other critical sectors, including the welfare of the citizen, infrastructure, education, health. So the government is thinking that even when those funds are freed, a part of it will go also to workers' welfare. So as to where the city think it is, because there seems to be an agreement across different players in that negotiation, that there is going to be a price increase. But when that price increase will be, how much, when that salary increase will be, and how much of an increase it will be, are things that still need to be ironed out. And some negotiations can take as long as 6 months to even a year before a conclusion is made. Because it's not just about the federal government. There is a national minimum wage, which means that by law, once it is agreed and signed into law, it is applicable to the organized private sector, it's applicable to the state governors, and even the local governments. So we have to also look at the capacity of those levels of government and other key players like the organized private sector to pay. So regarding how feasible it is, it's just the start of a long-drawn process, and we hope that at the end of the day, we come to an agreement.
Ibrahim Momo is a political analyst. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. We'll be right back. In Uganda, attorney Mathias Mpuuga, the leader of the opposition in parliament, says it was disappointing for President Yoweri Museveni to expose legislators and others to COVID-19. This, he says, despite knowing that he had tested positive to the coronavirus. The president recently delivered the State of the Nation address in parliament. He said one of three samples tested positive. He has since gone into forced leave, delegating his duties to Prime Minister Rabin and Nabanja. Mpuuga also expressed concern that significant amounts of public funds are used to test citizens for the disease who attended public events attended by Museveni. A negative test is required before any meeting with the president. Attorney Mathias Mpuuga tells me that the president should have given speeches via Zoom to protect the public.
Well, what is very interesting is the coincidence of being the only person that insists on being testing everyone before meeting him. But again, it turns out that he's the only person who is sick. So that coincidence can only be explained by witchcraft, not science. And you see, the gist of our advice that we gave yesterday, laying the fact that, one, the testing centers are concentrated to one of two centers. Secondly, it became costly for the taxpayer to fork out 5 billion Ghanaian shillings at every occasion Museveni was going to meet people. So this week and next week, 5 billion for State of the Nation, 5 billion for the budget speech. We don't need that. I am right now doing oversight into the countryside, schools without basic necessities, without furniture, without toilets, without classrooms. You can't spend that money. So if there is a state of COVID, then the president can deliver his speech on Zoom. We also advise him and his family that are vulnerable because of age to take a booster dose. So if he's that vulnerable to COVID-19, we advise him to stay home, speak to the people via Zoom, also take a booster dose. So his declaration of COVID infection is a bit suspect. Probably we shall get the truth going forward.
But what also, do you mean is declaration of testing positive to COVID is a bit suspect? I don't you believe what the science says?
Only him has seen the science, not any other person. So that I don't believe in the science. Why it is suspect is because he's the only person who tests everyone coming close to him. Those coming close to him are not sick, but he's sick. Secondly, it comes at the backdrop of us questioning the wisdom of compulsory testing, which means that they're trying to really play back and make it validate the requirement for testing that we believe is a money-minting project for a few regime operatives. Would not
but some people are suggesting
from him.
Some people are suggesting that the specific places where the tests are taken are for security reasons, because these are security implications. Those places, they argue, have been properly equipped to ensure that security is not compromised.
Again, I don't believe that, because we have facilities that have been testing people that are traveling, that have been testing members of parliament before, and they were never questioned. Why are they being questioned now when WHO has declared COVID no longer an international pandemic of emergency nature? They were testing hitherto and there was no problem. So why are they a problem now? I was in audience of the president in the same place 2 years ago, using different labs and hospitals, and there was no problem. So when did it become a security problem? It's just validation of wastage.
So are you saying that opposition lawmakers should forthwith boycott President Museveni's speeches if these amounts of money would have to be spent, or now that he has contracted the disease, he should speak via Zoom only?
It is actually both. His declaration of COVID infection vindicates our position, namely that he can deliver his speech via Zoom, but also that money would be saved. So for the country, it's a double benefit. They will listen to him, but also stay away from him. But also, it brings his assertion into perspective. He knew he had COVID. Why did he move to address people? what did he have to really go and address people aware that he's sick? How to declare immediately after his speech? What's his intention?
Are you saying that the president deliberately exposed people who came to the State of the Nation address to COVID?
Exactly. That's my point. Because he declared himself infected immediately after his speech. So why did he have to really subject people to that kind of danger and expose them to possible infection when he was aware that he was infected?
Attorney Mathias Mpuuga is a Ugandan parliamentarian. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. Listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, from all over the world have begun to arrive in South Africa ahead of Sunday's 96th edition of the Comrades Marathon. Run between the cities of Pietermaritzburg and Durban, the 89-kilometer route is laden with spectators on the side of the road from start to finish. The prize pool of $220,000 shared equally between men's and women's winners makes it the richest race on the African continent. Defending men's champion Tete Dijana and former women's winner Gerda Stern are two of the favorites this year. For VOA, Myron Nika has this preview for us from Durban.
That's the iconic Chariots of Fire. Vangelis's masterpiece brings the crowd to their feet as the winner of the Comrades Marathon heads towards the finish line. It's among the many traditions of this century-old race. The brainchild of World War I veteran Vic Clapham, the Comrades Marathon was first run in 1921 to commemorate South African soldiers killed during the war. A small group of 34 runners entered the race that year, paving the way for an event that has stood the test of time. This year, more than 17,000 runners will line up at the start in Pietermaritzburg to make their way towards the coast. The journey to the finish line in Durban is undulating, creating a unique challenge for both elite and amateur runners. Celebrated South African runner Sean Micklejohn, who won the race back in 1995, counts it as one of the proudest moments in his career.
Being a Comrades winner is something that many top athletes dream of and only a few achieve. It was the proudest moment of my running career, and now I have a winner's blaze that I can wear with pride, even if it is only once or twice a year. And my name is now engraved on the winner's trophy, which is forever.
For more than 50 years, only white South Africans were allowed to run the race due to the apartheid laws in South Africa. Today, in a democratic country, the race attracts a melting pot of people. Over 2,400 runners from around the world will line up at this year's race. 173 athletes from the USA will join the field, while India, with 403 runners, is the leading nation outside of South Africa. This runner, who hails from India, says completing the Comrades Marathon is at the top of his road running ambitions.
It is a prestigious marathon and the oldest marathon, and it is in my bucket list. That's why I came here through India, and toughest marathon in the world. So I want to check my endurance. That's why I came here.
The race, which starts at 5:30 a.m., has cutoffs at various distances. The main cutoff at the finish is at 5:30 p.m. More than 85% of the field come home in the final hour of the race.
Runners spend close to 12 hours on the road, pushing their physical and mental endurance limits. But as these athletes attest, despite the pain experienced, the incredible feeling of crossing the finish line makes them come back for more.
Now, your character is what will push you to the finish line. So you need to be more of a strong person in terms of a character. You need to be very resilient as well, because I think after 60 kilometers, to be honest, your mental fitness kicks in and your physical fitness is already out of the window.
There's no better experience, my brother. If you haven't run the combats and you're a runner, you need to come here, because once the bug hits you, you'll never stop going.
When the massive field lines up outside the Pietermaritzburg City Hall, months and months of preparation will undergo what organizers have dubbed the ultimate human race. It will be boisterous. It will be festive. Then, silence, as South Africa's national anthem signals the start of proceedings. 100 years on, the race continues to embody the triumph of the human spirit. For VOA Africa, this is Myron Naika in Durban, South Africa.
Kenyan musical sensation and four-member band Soti Soul this week performed their final show in the United States after announcing the group's indefinite hiatus. VOA's Mike Hovey caught up with the band before its final show and produced this report.
The East African group, Soti Soul, left fans emotional after a thrilling performance in Washington, D.C., as they concluded their final six-city U.S. tour after taking to social media to announce a prolonged break. A statement released May 20 witnessed Soti Soul telling their fans that they'll be taking an indefinite hiatus a day before their show in Atlanta as part of the Madaraka Festival, a U.S.-based East African showcase. Simon Okele, the founder of Madaraka Festival, says Soti Soul's final U.S. tour was a spiritual journey for everybody.
You know, the announcement that Soti Soul made right before this tour has made this entire tour like a spiritual journey for everybody on the tour, you know?
Willis Austin Jimano, one of Soti Soul's vocalists, brought calm to fans after explaining the indefinite hiatus does not mark the end of the group.
It's not the last, it's a hiatus. And still, at the end of it all, we have been together since high school for such a long time.
Soti Soul member and guitarist Polly Gup says the hiatus could end at any time.
Well, we said indefinite hiatus, so it could take 2 years, it could take 2 months, it could take 5 years, whatever it is.
Soti Soul's record label, Soul Generation, has vowed to release a new album and continue other projects, this despite the break by its founders.
So the record label is very much intact. We're about to sign new artists. So that's our legacy, as they say. So there's a lot of umbrellas that are around the Soul group.
Group vocalist Savara says Soti Soul has successfully been together for over 18 years due to professional guidance and their strong bond as friends.
It's a marriage between four people. A marriage between four people has to be sorted out by professionals. So, like, anytime we need help, we seek help. We have a therapist, we have people who mentor us.
Vote for the 2014 MTV EMA Best African.
The East African group has a long list of accomplishments to their name. Among them, the award for Best Africa Act at the 2014 MTV Europe Music Awards. And in 2021, a Grammy certificate for featuring on Burna Boy's Twice as Tall album that won the Global Music Album Award. Bien Aim Baraza, the fourth member of the group and vocalist, says performing and dancing alongside former U.S. President Barack Obama is among the group's highest accomplishments.
We've been so lucky to have so many amazing moments. I think dancing with Obama is a moment for us.
It was amazing. Soti Soul is set to tour Europe next, finalizing their international performances in Vancouver, Canada on September 3 before starting their hiatus. Mike Ove, VOA News, Washington.
Right now, it's time for music from our African collection.
That Friday feeling, come again. Only goodbyes and energy. We're gonna dance the night away. Me and my
crew gon' tear it up tonight. Tell somebody, leo tupatane kileleni, tukaribishe wageni, me and my crew gon' tear it up tonight. I'm setting myself free, ring the authorities, shit talking jealousy won't take a toll on me. This is not your normal party, this is Vogue, there's a dress code, every corner's getting flashy, stay wise, stay bold, utani pata kati kati, if you know, I guess you know, every color on my mind, I'm gonna let it out tonight. That Friday feeling's come again, only the vibes and energy, we're gonna dance the night away, me and my crew gon' tear it up tonight. Tell somebody, look to patane kinele ni, to kari pishe wageni, me and my crew gon' tear it up tonight. Na 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 na, na na na.
Put me in your diary. is Divine Tembemba from Pretoria in South Africa. And you are listening to Nightline Africa from the Voice of America with Peter Clothy. Stay tuned and don't change the dial.
You're my energy. I will give you my love. I will give you all of me. 40 days and 40 nights in the wilderness of fire now. Lower lows and higher highs. Still I never found enough. Do me well, you do me right. High me up like marijuana. Got me canceling my flight. Oh, yeah. And if you call me for 3 a.m. need to be. If you wanna chill with the boys, you touch it. Even if you tell me a line, I believe. No one other man them say I'm naive.
You got the keys to my heart.
You got the keys.
My baby never lets me down.
My baby never.
My baby never lets me down.
Ooh,
my baby never. You deserve a crown. My baby never lets me down. My baby never lets me down. My baby never. Oh,
baby, you're my. Give you all of me, baby. You're my killer, baby. You're my energy. I go give you moolah. I go give you all of me. For 3 a.m. meet a peak, baby. Cause you stole my heart like a thief. Even if you tell me a line, it's a belief. No one of my girlfriends call me naive. And you need, you're all I need.
Listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clothy, in Washington, D.C. That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Michael Hovve, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, the charcoal seller's daughter will one day wear a white gown. I'm your host.